Yep. Harry'sRazors.com. You know, Harry's.com, they are the greatest razors in the whole world.
Well, without a doubt.
Do you want to know why they're the best?
Well, you tell me your reason, I'll tell you mine.
Because they own the manufacturing plant that makes the razors.
In
they
Germany.
They don't buy them from someone, they own it. Well, it's November. Do you know what November's popular for?
Don't shave the stash.
Movember.
Yeah.
Movember is the time of year where people grow a mustache.
And Scott, let me tell you, you can't have a beard and a mustache.
No, it's mustache. A mustache. Yeah, it's Movember, not Beervember. It's Movember. So you still have to shave. But Movember is, and Harry's is a partner with Movember that helps you grow the mustache in awareness and to help raise funds for men's health issues. And Harry's is a big sponsor of that. We want to recognize them and say thank you for that. But you still got to shave the sideburns, right?
You got to get that. You got to get the whiskers off the side of the face, and no better way to do it.
I still have a streak going right now. I have not yet cut myself since using the Harry's razor. I think we've been using them for now, what, 2 years? And I have not yet cut myself.
Well, Scott, I'm not as lucky as you are. I sometimes get a little bit sloppy when I'm trying to capture
gotta
that.
Got to be awake.
Capture that one hair of mine that's on my chin.
So get your $5 off of any purchase by going to harrys.com and enter the code
TRN. Scott, I was running on the trail the other day, and it was early in the morning, and two runners were coming up, and I was coming down the trail, and I heard them say, "Now that's a light."
You mean a torch?
A torch.
Pentel.com. Go get yourself one.
If you want to be in an environment that really is, number one, safe, because you're going to be able to see your surroundings, you've got to pony up and get yourself the right equipment.
My wife is crewing someone this weekend at the RDL 100, and she said, I'm going to need a headlamp. And mm-hmm. I go, no, you're not going to need a headlamp. All you need is a torch. I have an extra Petzl, and she's going to take the Petzl, and she's going to illuminate that aid station with that Petzl.
And one of the cool things is about, I've got two things to say, Scott, and I'll make it quick, is that for a crew, if you're looking down at the paper and looking down at some stuff, bang, that reactive lighting, yep, down to 7 lumen, and you look forward, and depending on which one you have, you may be with 200 plus to 500 lumen as you gaze out looking for your runner. Pretty amazing.
Or for etiquette purposes, I know you've had this happen to you before where someone has their headlamp on and they look up at your face, they're not getting that 575 lumen in the face.
And that was what I was going to say, Scott. And we've been on the same page today, mm-hmm, you and I. Etiquette, light etiquette. Either turn it off, spin it around when you come up on other trail runners. That's just something that took me a while to figure out. You know, just there's a nice etiquette piece to mind your light.
There is. So go to Petzl.com, find out about the Tika RXP, find out about the Now, NAO.
Go over to Trail Runner Nation, hit the partners page, and link over to Petzl and select your torch.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And today we have ultra runner extraordinaire Ian Sharman. I don't know if you've, do you know about Ian?
Oh, I know plenty about Ian. I know that if you want to see Ian, you better show up early to an aid station because he's coming through with the lead pack. That I know about
him. He pushes the aid station captains to be ready on time. He has been a top 10 finisher Western States 6 different times. I think you hold the Leadville 100 record, don't you, Ian?
I wish. I'd love to get it one day, but no, I've won it a couple of times. But
yeah,
I don't
you've
have
won
the
it a couple
there.
Of times.
I thought the record is Matt Carpenter, and it's one of the all-time great records in ultra running.
But humble Ian, we'll tell you because he won't, a Grand Slam record holder. Is
that's
that true?
Right.
Yeah, I got that one, yeah. So Leadville's part of that.
Yeah, there you go.
But, so you were not as quick as Matt ran it.
You weren't entirely wrong, Scott.
So we do qualify our guests.
Absolutely.
They have to either be funny or fast, or be able to run.
Or informative.
and we have all three today.
Ian, welcome to the podcast.
No pressure on me for that, yeah?
Hey, welcome back to the podcast. We've had you on here before, Ian. Let's talk about this grand announcement. Are we ready to dive into that, Scott?
I think we are. The first I heard about it, I had flashbacks of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, because we have something that Ian has developed with his coaching group called the Golden Ticket. Ian, you want to give us some details on that?
Yeah, in fact, it's not so much that I developed it, it's more I just saw an opportunity there. So Western States, every year, it has a set of races where you can automatically qualify. So there's the qualification of you need to have run a certain distance just to get in the lottery. But then for super quick people, there's in the past, it was the Montreal Ultra Cup in recent years. And if you were in the top couple of places in those races, then you got into Western States. And that was the way for quick people to get in. It was pretty much the only way they could get in unless they were lucky in the lottery. Montreal stopped being the Western States sponsor as of this year. So the last year they did was 2015. And then when they announced the races that were going to make up the qualifiers, Western States didn't have an overall sponsor for that. So given that my coaching business has been growing very fast, and it's, you know, this is a part of the running world that is ultras and trail in particular that is just booming at the moment, I kind of jumped on that and said, okay, well, let's see if there's something that I can do to help support the race. So they announced it, calling them the Golden Ticket races, and I said, can I help support that and sponsor it and be involved in that way? Because as you mentioned, I've been to Western States the last 6 years. It's a really big part of my life, and the same with the other coaches that I have at Charmin Ultra. We've got Ellie Greenwood, Liza Howard, Sandra Andal, and Sean Meissner. All of them have run it. People like Sean have actually paced and crewed there multiple times, including for me. So we're all really, really involved with that race. So it made a lot of sense to try and partner with it in that way. So now all the people who are trying to qualify for Western States in the races that are held in the 6 months before next year's race will have the chance to do it with a little bit of support from my side of things, which is, you know, supporting the overall Western States, and a bit of money goes towards each of the races themselves that are the qualifiers. And then also, as part of that, I'm giving away free coaching to one person who gets into Western States through the lottery.
And let's hold that free coaching thing, because I want to talk about that, some of the coaching that might be involved with that specific to the race. But I've got to think Golden Ticket isn't only for the athlete, but also for the races that qualify. I would love to be a race director learning that I'm a Golden Ticket race. I would imagine that would spike impact and create a lottery of its own.
Which races are they, Ian? Do you have them off the top of your head?
Let me just get it up so I on the screen, so I definitely have the right list, because it's similar to last year's list of races, but it's not the same. But as I'm doing that, so it's not so much that they get just randomly picked. So it's not like Western States just announces these are the qualifiers. It's like with the Montreal Ultra Cup, they were typically all actually sponsored by Montreal, as well as Western States being sponsored by Montreal. This year, it's a much smaller degree of things because I'm not a massive international corporation.
It's coming.
Well, I'm not sure I'd ever want to get to that point, even if it was feasible, but... So the races are in January in Texas, Bandera 100K, that's been one of the qualifiers for a few years. Sean O'Brien 100K in California in February, and that was in it for 2015. Black Canyon 100K, that was also in it for 2015, and that's in Arizona. Georgia Death Race, which is over in Georgia, obviously on the East Coast. Gorge Waterfalls 100K, which was again a 2015 qualifier, and that's in Oregon. And Lake Sonoma 50 miler, the super competitive 50 miler in California in April.
So do you have to outright win the race, or kind of what happens, who gets that golden ticket?
So it's the top two men and top two women, and it can drop down as far as fifth if people who are in the higher positions have already got a place in Western States. So if they're already in it through the lottery, or more likely they were a top 10 last year, or even they'd already won or done well enough in one of the previous golden ticket races, then it can drop down someone else. So the idea being that you do get two men and two women that come from every single race.
So what if I'm not in the race? Say I place and I get a golden ticket, but I just don't want to run that race because it's not right for my schedule or something happens. Do I have to be in the race before I can pass it down?
No. So you could only get it if you're in that position. So let's say you go to Georgia Death Race, you come second, but you decide you don't want to run Western States.
Yeah.
Then it passes on to the next person.
Got
so
it.
Even if you didn't already have the entry, guaranteed from previous ones, it would still pass down to someone else if you turn it down.
So either you're qualified for the race or you're not just not going to run it, it can still trickle down to the next runner.
But it does tend, and like you said, you know, that each of these races, it means that they get a lot higher competition than they otherwise would, because the fast people who want to get into Western States are going to turn up at these races, and it's pretty much the only way they can get in. So particularly because I'm not sure of the exact specifics of this, but I know that in the past, even though international elites could get in through the Ultra Trail World Tour, mm-hmm. I think for American elites, they say you can't be in as part of the Ultra Trail World Tour. You have to still qualify or be lucky in the lottery.
Hmm. Now, for a lot of our international listeners, that list that you gave is North America races only. There's nothing internationally that is qualifying for the golden ticket.
And so if you're a super quick international runner, you could come to these and you could qualify, and that's one option. You could also be ranked highly enough in the whatever way they rank things for the Ultra Trail World Tour, so that you say that you're going to do at least three of the races in the Ultra Trail World Tour. You want one of them to be Western States, and they say, yep, you're speedy. We'll sort that out for you. But yeah, I mean, for quick international runners, like super quick international mm-hmm. runners, they can get in that way. For, you know, the 99.9% of other runners, they'd either have to do the lottery, like most people, or if they're quick enough, they could potentially qualify through one of these races. But I'd actually argue that it's probably harder to qualify and come in the top two in these races than it would be to, say, be top 10 the previous year at Western States. So my hopeful way to keep doing things for the next few years is, if I can keep being top 10, then I know even at the finish line that I'm in for next year, I don't have to worry about racing some super quick people and having to get in 6 months down the line.
And let's be honest, to be in the top 10, you have to be super quick, Ian. It's not like you can be a slug.
You can't be slow, but yeah, I think you have to be even quicker to be able to win one of these races.
But I like what Western States is doing. They're making sure that there's a competitive piece of the field in every one of these races. So it isn't every man's, every person's race, where if you can get it done in 30, you're still important and they still make place for you. But they also have the faster side to tune in early and watch the outcomes.
Yeah, I agree. I think it makes the whole thing very interesting. I've always followed the Montreal Ultra Cup in the past. I actually won the Montreal Ultra Cup a couple of years ago, but that's mainly because people use it mainly as a way to get into the race, and then they don't necessarily focus on doing enough races to score enough points, so I got a little bit lucky there. But for example, you were saying about people can qualify and then do well at Western States. Magda Boulay, mm-hmm. she qualified at, which one was it? I think it was Black Canyon? Or, I don't know, it was a different set of races last year, but she qualified with one of the Ultra Cup qualifiers and then goes to Western States and wins.
Right. So with that said, why Western States? I mean, how come it is such a focused global event that everybody, golden tickets, etc.?
Well, I think that your analogy there with Willy Wonka and obviously the fact they call it a golden ticket race is meant to be using that analogy, but it's because it's kind of the big dance, people call it. It is the biggest ultra, I would say, in the US in terms of popularity, international attention. It is just an amazing race, and I think most of that comes from the history. Yeah. So at some point that may run out if they can't attract an elite field and if they can't keep people interested. But for the moment, I'd still say it is the premier race, and it's mainly because it's the race that invented 100-mile trail running.
Nice. You know, Ian, I can tell by your accent that you're not a native to North America.
How can you tell?
as far as international notoriety, how does Western States stack up? I mean, we look at a lot of these international races like UTMB and some of these others across the pond. How does Western States how important is that internationally?
I'd argue that I think UTMB is the one that globally gets the most attention, gets the most top level runners. It's a much bigger race. You've got thousands of people there, plus you've got other distances. So over the full kind of week of racing, you've got, I don't know, 5,000 to 10,000 people running, never mind all their support crews and the local villages helping out and stuff. But I would say, UTMB is probably the biggest. But then Western States is pretty much right up there. And it's mainly, I think, because of that history and because it does attract very fast runners. I mean, it's attracted top level Europeans and other nationalities like Kilian Jornet. He came a couple of years and won it. There was Ryan Sands from South Africa. He's raced there a few times. There's been a lot of the top level runners who do mountain and trail stuff of the longer distances turn up to Western States because it still has that prestige. So I think I saw it in one of Killian's many videos that he had a list of all the races he wanted to win. And it was only, I don't know, maybe 10 races that were the biggest, best races in the world. And Western States was on there. And I think that gives an idea of the kind of appeal to people around the world that it is the big one to, if you're thinking of traveling to the US for a race and you like ultras, Western States is probably number one on the list. I'd actually say from an international perspective, the next most well-known one is probably Badwater. Even though it's a much lower key race, it's not very competitive. It's just because it's kind of that crazy thing of running in Death Valley in the extreme heat. And it gets international TV coverage. It's had films made about it. So I would say Western States and Badwater are probably the two races that people are most likely to have heard of if they don't know that much about, even if they don't know that much about U.S. ultra running.
And it's kind of crazy, you know, 380 runners, but still getting all that attention. It's not that big of a race when you look at the starting line, but still.
But there's not that many runners in the Olympic marathon. That gets a lot of attention, too.
Good point.
If you make it an important enough race that and there's enough competition there and enough history, that's what gets people interested, I think.
Agreed.
So let's talk about this coaching thing, Ian. Okay. Let's, part of the golden ticket, I think it's part of the golden ticket, is how does one get this six-month free coaching and what is involved in that?
So that is, it's not actually to one of the golden ticket winners because they'd be qualifying after the point where this is awarded, but it's at the lottery stage. So in December, in fact, it's I think tomorrow is when the lottery opens, and then they pick the winners at the beginning of December. And one of the people who gets picked as the winner of getting into Western States, so of the 380 odd people, if they've checked the box that says they're interested in being put in another lottery for free coaching, then if they get into Western States, they can also win a 6 month coaching from lottery date to Western States.
So that's it's a double dip. There's two lotteries. So if you get lucky enough to get your number drawn, and you want to, you get put in another bucket, and at the end of the lottery, you get pulled and get some coaching.
Once they've picked all the people who are going to be in the race, of them, Western States will then pick randomly one more runner who said that they were interested in coaching for free, and of them, one of them will be coached by me through to the race.
Do you actually think that someone's going to say no to that?
I'm sure some of them, they would already have coaches, for example, so it would be a waste for them to win another coach who would be conflicting potentially with the advice they're getting, but I'd hope that most people would be interested, and I kind of stake my reputation on the people that I've trained for Western States and other races, and on my own ability to get the most out of my body when I go there as well.
Right.
Hey, so does that the coaching golden ticket, does it trickle down? Can I give it to a friend in need?
We haven't discussed that, but you could if you wanted to. I suppose. Yeah. I mean, if you win it, and you could give it to someone else who's training for Western States if you wanted, but. Yeah, I think that would be reasonable. So, we haven't specifically said that, but...
Well, you have now. You have.
Reasonable.
Ian, you have now. And, I can lift that audio and put it right on Twitter. And
at least the two people that listen to the podcast now have you committed.
Well, that's why I was putting it on Twitter.
One person who probably won't check that box is me, because I don't really see the point of putting myself in for the lottery for my own coaching, because I already coach me.
hey, so let's talk about the importance of a coach. Yeah. Because if it, as tough as it is to get into Western States or your premier race, whether it's Western or another race, so it applies to everything, how important it is not to squander that bib, the opportunity to perform at your very best, and what kind of better insurance policy than to link arms with someone that's been there, done that, and knows about it. So let's just talk about the difference between going in blind and just hoping for the best and getting a map or a navigator to help you out.
Well, I think the fact there are so many lotteries makes it much more likely that people want coaches now, because let's say you get into Western States and you probably won't get in for another decade just through the lottery. If you're lucky, maybe it would take a decade. So.
Right.
Given that, people think, well, I'm really committing to this. This is my one chance for the foreseeable future to do the race. So I want to make sure I can go there and not just have the steep learning curve on the day and go, I wish I'd done this or that differently, and instead have someone guide them through. Because there is such a steep learning curve to ultra running. And a lot of people who get into something like Western States, it might be their first or second 100 mile, or they might have done 100K, for example, to get into the lottery. And then Western States is their first 100 mile, and there's a lot of unknown territory there. Plus, every race in the trail world is very different to every other race. If you do one road marathon, you've kind of, you know what a road marathon is, and it'll be similar to other ones. If you do one trail ultra, it might be completely different to another one. So you might have qualified in 100K close to where you live, and then Western States has the heat and the downhills and all of these factors to get into it, plus the fact it's 100 miles. So I think it means people are more likely to want some guidance with that. And it's really shown that if you have good guidance and you have a good coach, because there are a lot of coaches out there now, so there's obviously varying quality, then that person can help guide you through not just the training sessions you're doing. That's quite a minor part of it, really, but also this is the mindset. This is the tactics you're going to have on race day. These are the things that you'll need to deal with, so we're going to practice that within the training, like eating and drinking, or how are you going to keep yourself cool, or just the kind of things you've got to be thinking about to make sure you can get to that finish line and do it as well as possible.
Now, how do you qualify a coach? You said a moment ago, there are so many coaches out there. How do you make sure that you don't fall into a trap and end up with a coach that maybe the coach is the right person for somebody else, but how do you qualify your coach?
I would say there's only one way, really, because getting qualifications such as from the USATF, you can get coaching qualifications, you can get personal training qualifications, and there's numerous other things. So I've got a personal training from National Academy of Sports Medicine, as well as USATF coaching certification. But really, I think that's only a minor part of it. It helps to have that foundation and have some scientific background to it. But a coach needs to be much more well-versed than that. And most importantly, they need to be a good listener. I think that's one of the key things. And the only way you can find out how good a coach is, really, is by what other people say about the coach. So testimonials, or if a friend of yours was coached by them, that's really the only way you can tell, because just looking at someone's qualifications on a website, or lack of them, doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot. And just winning races also doesn't tell you a whole lot about whether the person can coach someone well.
So if you were looking to engage in a coach, Ian, would you expect to interview the coach or have a discussion with them? I mean, what happens without encroaching upon their time? You don't want to take a test drive to New York in a car that you're buying in California. What is it that you can do to get a good interview process, and what kind of questions should a person ask?
I have to admit that because of the fact that I usually have a wait list for coaching, so I'm not able to always offer that.
Sure.
So what I suggest to people instead is listen to things like podcasts that I do. So I would say that another good way for people to find out about coaches is listen to some of the interviews they've given, because most coaches will have talked about their philosophies, and you can get a good sense of how personable they are, whether your personality would fit with theirs or not. So I would say that that's probably way more in-depth than you'll get just from asking a few questions, especially if those questions are only over email, which you don't really get a sense of the personality and the fit from that. But the other way is if you know anyone who's been coached by them, that's probably interview them, because they'll have much more in-depth analysis of how good the coach is than if you ask a few questions and the coach has some good answers to them. But you still can't get that much of a sense in, 15 or 30 minutes of just how well you'll mesh with that person. But so I think that testimonials and word of mouth is by far the most important thing. I think listening to any interviews they've given is very important. And I certainly see that with several of the top coaches out there. They're regularly on podcasts, and it's very easy to get a sense of what their philosophy is, how they think, and most importantly, it's how they adapt things for people. So when they're asked questions, and they don't just have a set answer of this is what we'd always do. Every question should always basically be, it depends, and here's some examples of how it depends.
That reminds me about one of the podcasts we did with Ann Trason. Every question we asked her, she says, well, it kind of depends. Every single answer was that.
Well, that's one of the things about ultra running compared to marathoning. And marathoning, there's a lot more research. It's a lot more uniform in terms of what the body is going through from one person to another. So it's a lot easier to have more similarities between one person's training and another's. Should still be very tailored to the individual, but there's going to be way more overlap than there would be for two people who are training for, say, you know, Western States, for example, or Leadville, where they might live in completely different environments. And a lot of things have to be made very specific of how they're going to deal with the specificity of what that race will involve.
So I may put you on the spot here. Have you ever not taken a client because you didn't think that they were a good fit for you?
Yeah, no, there's been a couple of times that's happened where I just felt that the kind of help is, it's usually if I feel that they need someone in person, because my services are online. And sometimes when someone is asking a million questions, and particularly if they have a lot of injuries in the past, I'll sometimes say it would be better to work with, say, a personal trainer first who can be there with you physically, because they need a little bit more hand-holding to help along the way. And particularly with injuries, if you're coming off lots of them, it's more difficult necessarily to get into coaching with that. So usually when I start with someone, they wouldn't have serious injuries at that point. They may have had them in the past, but that would be an important part of working out whether it's an appropriate time to start coaching with them. I've also said to people, okay, if you can see a physical therapist and maybe a personal trainer, see where we are in a couple of months, then we could start. But right now, I can't help as much through the remote process because you need people in person. And obviously, you know, one or two people maybe over the years who there's a bit of a personality clash, and usually they still get benefit out of it, but just not as much as they could. And I'll usually suggest after a few months, say, I'm not sure this is working as well as it could be. I think maybe another coach would be a better option, because, and this is typically if they're not listening to my advice. So if I write a training plan for them, and every time I speak to them, they've done nothing like what's in there, that's usually a sign that they're not really benefiting from the advice. Because if you don't take the advice, then it's kind of useless to you.
Yeah. That's a very diplomatic answer. I think I think that you probably have a filter of some kind that says, whoa, this person is psychotic. I cannot work with this person.
I'm lucky. I've not had anyone I've thought anything like that. But I know what you mean. I've certainly met people in the ultra world occasionally who I thought I wouldn't want to coach them, but no one who's actually approached me.
Well done. Hey, so what are the...
That's why he has a team of coaches. So if he doesn't completely mesh with someone, he says, hey, why don't you take this one?
I've got the right person for you.
Well, actually, that is one of the benefits of having a diverse set of coaches is that someone might not be a perfect fit for me. So let's say, here's an easy example. They have children, they're pregnant at the moment. I may not be able to give quite as good advice to that person as someone like Liza Howard, who's got a young child herself and has obviously run through pregnancy and done very well through it. She got the Umstead course record while breastfeeding at aid stations.
Yeah, right.
So that's the kind of thing where she's obviously going to have a lot more insight than I can possibly give to some of those scenarios. So it helps to have that diverse base of coaches who have different skill sets, but an overarching philosophy behind it all.
Hey, so just an overall observation, and I know the answer is going to be the and trace, and it depends, but let's just speak broad brushstroke here. Do you feel that, and have you witnessed that male athletes are better with male coaches or better if it's male and female? You know, have you seen a mix of gender preferences or sorting?
Not hugely. Occasionally I get, usually when people contact the company, they say, I would like this coach or that coach. Mm-hmm. You know, they already have a preference there, but it's not necessarily based on sex. It's sometimes based on the experience of which races that person's training for or location. So Ellie, for example, Ellie Greenwood lives in Canada. So most Canadians opt for Ellie because they feel it's more local for one thing. And obviously she's a world-class athlete and by far the highest profile person that I work with. Mm-hmm. In general, the one thing I would say is that women are more likely to hire a coach than men. So across the ultra running board, it's a male dominated sport, and even more so the longer the distance. But I would say half the people we coach are women. So they are definitely more likely to ask for that help. And I think that's the standard thing of men won't ask for directions. So I think it's probably related to that.
Hey, that's a good point. So and I still want to hit on this coaching thing, Scott. Sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. So best practices, industry standards, if we're looking for a coach, would we expect to enter into a contract? Are there contracts and things like that? Or what would we expect to find if we were on the hunt?
Typically, you'd want it to have some degree of flexibility. I mean, I offer basically month to month, or you can get a discount if you commit to 6 months at a time. Mm-hmm. And that means that if someone just wants to test the waters, they can go for a month, and that's usually enough time they'll get a good sense of it. Or if they're already certain, let's say they get into Western States and they've got 6 months till the race, so they want 6 months of coaching, mm-hmm. Then they're more likely to commit to that immediately. But it's that kind of flexibility. So the contract is usually just, you've got to give me a bit of notice. So if they're doing month to month, it's give me at least a couple of weeks notice if you want to stop at any point. But also, if you're finding something isn't working, let me know about it as soon as possible so we can try and make the coaching more effective rather than just you stopping contact and then just saying, I'm done now.
Good. Any other coaching stuff?
Yeah, I want to get into some specific coaching things. If you want to learn more about Ian, you can go to charminian.blogspot.com. And the most recent little blog post you have here is on heart rate monitors. And Don and I have kind of fluctuated up and down. We've been really intense with heart rate monitors and then just thrown them away for a while. And I think we're kind of on the upswing of that because we have a really cool heart rate monitor that we've been working with that doesn't go around your chest and make you have trouble breathing. Talk to us about heart rate monitor training and racing and why it's important and what pitfalls can you fall into if with heart rate monitors.
I think that the main pitfall people can have is that they treat it as being some kind of perfect measure, and like it boils down all these complicated things that are going on to one number. And that's just not really the case. And a really good example of that is when you're running downhill. So let's say you're doing a long race and you're doing a downhill and your heart rate might be quite low, but you've also got to be judging, are you pounding your legs too much? You've got to make it sustainable for that. And that won't necessarily be reflected in the heart rate, which could imply that you could speed up and you could really hammer your legs. But then on the next hill, you've just got jelly legs, even though you didn't really work your cardio system as hard. So I think that's one thing to be aware of, that it's just, it can be a useful guide as long as you don't treat it as being some kind of absolute perfect number. And I would say within training, the most useful way to look at it is just to make sure that your easy days are easy enough and to make sure that on the hard days, you do push yourself. So in particular for people who maybe are used to doing a lot of their running in a kind of middle intensity, they always go out the door and run at the same speed no matter what they're doing. And they don't have speed sessions, they don't have recovery sessions, there's not as much focus. For someone like that, it can be a useful way to just let them see the difference between a hard effort and an easy effort and really differentiate those. But I wouldn't be, I don't tend to think of things in terms of heart rate zones and, oh, this run you've got to do it at this number of beats per minute and hold it to that. And then at the end, it can go up 2 beats per minute. That, I think, is where people go wrong because they're trying to be too precise. And they're also losing the ability to judge intensity for themselves without some kind of external monitor. Saying that, though, in a race, I think a really useful way to use it, maybe in a 100-miler, is just have an idea from previous races and training what kind of heart rate might be sustainable for that distance of race, and then just use it as a rough guide that you don't really want to go above that, but not being too hard and fast. It's mainly, say, on the uphills to avoid running uphill and getting a massive spike in your heart rate. It can be a reminder that you should keep that intensity at a more sustainable level. And so that's one of the main ways. And I've used that a couple of times myself in races where I'm just vaguely looking at every now and then just to make sure the heart rate doesn't go too high. But I can equally do that just based off effort typically. So it depends on the individual and how good they are at judging their own intensity. But you also mentioned there about the straps going across the chest. And that's the typical way that most heart rate monitors work. I find that I can't do that for maybe a marathon, but not longer than that. Otherwise, I have massive rashes and and you know, it literally rips open holes in my chest. So I can't do that for a 100-miler, for example. But I've got a new thing now from a company called LifeBeam where it's in the hat. So it's a very cool little thing that syncs with the watch. So I can still get the heart rate monitor, but it's on the head rather than around the chest. So that I found is just more comfortable. And that's why recently I've been trying things out in 100-milers, because previously I never would, because I just didn't want to have scars all over my chest.
So how is the connection with that up in the hat? Is it hook up pretty well? Does it stay connected? Does
works
it stay synced?
Yeah, in fact, I'd say it works a little bit better than some heart rate monitor around the chest, because I've always found, I've only ever used Garmin's, but I found that with that, sometimes in the first mile or so, your heart rate spikes because the adhesion to the chest is not, you know, is not had enough sweat or whatever to make it be a good connection. So sometimes I'll start off a marathon, and that first mile, it's 40 beats per minute too high, which isn't actually what's happening. It's just what it thinks is happening. So for some reason with the hat, it doesn't have that anomaly, and it just works immediately without needing to be wet and sweaty in the first place.
So I want to go back to something that you mentioned and get your opinion on things. Let's say that you're in the race and you're or training run and you're running, and there is a big climb coming up, and you have your heart rate monitor on. What risks do you take if you're wanting to continue after this hill for, you know, a couple hours? What risks do you take by hammering the hill and taking your heart rate up to close to maximum heart rate versus saying, you know what, no, I'm not going to race up this hill. I'm going to keep my heart rate down. What are the benefits and concerns there?
Well, ultimately, in any race, particularly ultras, it's about efficiency, not high speed. There's no benefit in having a short period of really high intensity and then burning out. And the longer the race, the more that applies. So typically speaking, one of the key things that's behind all of the running and the coaching that I do is that it's vital to make sure that you're able to judge an intensity throughout the whole race to make it sustainable. And the heart rate monitor can maybe be a little bit useful for that, but it's much better typically to be able to judge it without that. So when I said that I've used the heart rate monitor in 100 milers, it was just to have very high level of, I know that for me, if it goes above about 150 beats per minute, that is definitely too much in a 100 miler. So I just use that as a little bit of a check sometimes, typically on the uphills, to maybe back off and switch from a run to a hike, or just try and make things a little bit easier a couple of times rather than having a couple of miles of it being a bit too intense and then paying the price 10 hours down the line, for example. So, I mean, in the extreme example you gave, if you hammer up the first hill and you've got to do a couple more hours, you're probably going to be exhausted for the rest of it. And then what becomes sustainable from then is a much slower effort. So you may have gained a couple of minutes on the hill, but then you lose a minute a mile for the rest of the race. So, I mean, there's a clear trade-off there that's bad. But where it's more subtle, where you're just going a little bit too fast, I still find that it does then lower the sustainable effort and pace that you can do for the rest of the race. So being able to judge your intensity is one of the key skills for an ultra runner. And I think that's one of the things that I try to get across over long periods with the coaching, is just to improve people's ability to do that, because it's often that they push too hard early on because they get caught up with the adrenaline, other people are running faster, or just the fact there's other people around. Well, in a long race, it spreads out and you don't see as many people. And because of that, it feels sustainable, because for 5 miles, going at, say, marathon intensity feels fine. Mm-hmm. But if they're running 100 miles, they're going to burn out fairly quickly at that kind of intensity. So it's trying to make sure they can tell the difference of what is sustainable and how easy you need to go sometimes, and just avoid those spikes in the heart rate and the effort level. So the heart rate monitor is a tool for that, but it's not the only tool. And the person's ability to judge it based on multiple race distances, experience, long runs, adjusting for the weather, and basically all these things of how they're feeling and being able to self-monitor, that's such a key part of any ultra runner's arsenal.
You know, you mentioned earlier, and I think it may have been Bob Crowley, I'm not sure, that we've had on the podcast before, that talked about heart rate in different distances. And he said that if it's, like you said, 150 beats per minute is you don't want to go beyond that for 100 miles. He would tell you what distance and what heart rate was associated with that distance, from 5K, 10K, half marathon, marathon. He just had that dialed in, and I just really thought that was pretty cool how he knew his numbers.
I've got a pretty good idea. I know what my heart rate would be roughly for a 5K through to 100 mile. And if it goes much above that, I know I'm going to burn out and I'm going to slow down. But I'm still not going to use that as my only guide. So it's much better also to have other races of a similar distance in the recent years or two, you know, just beforehand, so that you've got something to put it in context of. But also something like a 100 miler, it's so much more than just your fitness that comes into it. So a 5K, you can be more precise. You could know maybe that 173 beats per minute is your 5K effort. And if you start getting to 175, you're going to blow up. Mm-hmm. And if you're going at 171, you could be pushing harder. So you can be a lot more precise with something like that. While in a 100 miler, you've also got to be thinking, am I overheating? Am I eating enough? Am I hammering my legs on the downhill? Am I wearing enough clothing? Am I wearing too much clothing? All these things that you're monitoring. And I often use the analogy of, it's like you're in like a plane with a million dials in front of you, and you're just checking all of them are staying in line with what they should be. And as long as they are, the plane keeps moving forward. If suddenly, you know, one of them goes into the red, you deal with that one ideally before it goes into the red, because you see it going up. But and the more into the red it goes, the harder it is to deal with, and the more it'll distract you from monitoring the other things as well. So that's, I think, one of the difficulties of using just physical-based things like heart rate when there's so many other factors coming into it that aren't just about your fitness.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'd like to share, we talk about heart rate going up, but an area that I've used the heart rate monitor is the heart rate coming down. So if I'm stopping at an aid station or I'm just stopping to, you know, make an adjustment to some gear or something, I'll watch and see where my heart rate is and see how quickly it comes down. Not necessarily to resting, because obviously I'm not resting, but is it staying elevated or is it dropping as I would expect? And if it's not dropping fast enough, then I'm starting to move into some areas that metabolically I'm not keeping up with, and I need to recheck and rethink my effort so that I can have that return at a rate that I would normally see.
And that would be a signal typically that you've maybe pushed a little bit too hard for a little bit too long. And sometimes, especially with heat, extreme heat in particular, even 5 or 10 minutes of not looking after yourself and allowing yourself to overheat might take a few hours to fix. Mm. And that for those few hours, you're going to have to go slower, either because it just feels a lot harder or because you're vomiting or you're, you know, lots of things are starting to go wrong. So I think that that's one way that you can see kind of the after effects of having made a mistake. But also, if you're aware of that kind of thing, you can maybe notice it earlier so that you've only done a couple of miles of pushing too hard rather than you're 20 miles down the line and then you've really blown yourself up for the rest of the day.
Yeah, Coach Ian, that's really a good point. You know, how long can we expect for ourselves to return? I think many times we think it's going to happen quickly, you know, halfway to the next aid station. But we have to have some patience in returning and letting our plan of decreased effort or increased fueling or increased hydration takes time to turn that ship around.
And it's very much a qualitative type of thing that you've got to be able to judge all the factors together rather than just any one number like heart rate. So you've got to be able to, you know, ask yourself, does it feel sustainable now? Do I need to be reducing the effort? And that's a difficult question to answer. And that's where experience comes into it in a major way. But I think one of the key things really is to make sure that you're able to learn from that over time and get better at it. And ultimately, every race that I do, every training session pretty much, I learn a little bit more about how my body works. And I know that for decades to come, I'm going to keep refining things and hopefully becoming a better runner. But also sometimes you forget some of the lessons you've had in the past. And then you have a bad race or you make a mistake and you go, oh, yep, got to remember that one still. I haven't got that under control 100% automatically. I need to still be monitoring it.
And to your point about all the dials and the items to watch for, that if you watch, and I watched in my own racing and others that are around, that all of a sudden something happens to you, and it's not that your heart became more efficient or you became stronger. It's that learning curve and all those little pieces kind of come in. You started to understand the sport a bit more because it's more than just an athletic event. It is a decision-making process. It's
problem-solving.
It's apprentice to journeyman.
Problem-solving, I think, is the perfect way to think of it. Yeah. Yeah. I think it does involve a degree of intelligence there that it's maybe to a non-runner, they think it's just a mindless activity, but it really isn't. And especially doing the longer distances, you have to be thinking about the tactics, whether that's racing other people or your own pacing or looking after yourself or something's just gone wrong that you haven't experienced before. How do you fix that? How do you identify that something is starting to go wrong? All of these things are very much life skills in general, to be honest. And I find that I've learned a lot about myself and about my ability to do a lot of other things in life from the metaphor of a race, basically.
You're a competitive athlete. Many of us are competing against ourselves, against the course, against the heat. I mean, there's so many competitors out there that you can make a long list. But how do you, as a racer, make sure that your competitors don't get in your head and get in your game? How do you isolate what's happening to you with the field around you?
It is difficult, especially if things aren't going as well as you hope. And I think that's one of the, again as a coach, because I coach elite people as well as you know, middle of the pack, back of the pack, trying to get the cutoffs, everything. So there's differences in mindset there, but there's a lot of, there's probably more similarities than there are differences, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But when you're trying to race people and the aim is to be first or to be like top 10, for example, at Western States, you've got to be aware at least of what other people are doing. But a lot of it comes from confidence in your own tactics, confidence in your own ability, that if people zoom off, you just think, okay, it's a long race. I'll do my thing. That will give me the best possible time I can do. And sometimes that can be unnerving if they're all charging ahead and there's a big pack pulling away from you. But ultimately, just chasing them in pure reaction isn't necessarily the best thing to do, while in other cases it might be, especially for a shorter race. Let's say it's a 50K, you probably do have to just hang on to that pack because they probably aren't going to slow down, and certainly not the winner anyway. But then with the longer stuff, it's very much about thinking, what has worked for me in the past? How do these things tend to pan out? And typically in every 100-miler, you get a load of people charge off, a load of people blow up, some of them drop out. And so if you've reacted to them at mile 5 and then you've gone and burnt yourself out and then half of them drop out or they slow down dramatically, you've really just screwed up your race. So it's knowing that that's a consequence is an important part of it, and having the confidence in your own ability to pace things well and to know what you're doing. And so again, as a coach, a lot of what I'm doing, whether it's an elite athlete or someone whose main aim is a particular finish time or just to complete it, is still to instill that confidence in them that their plan is right and they don't need to massively change it just because their friend runs past them or something like that.
Mm-hmm. What is the most difficult thing for you to coach? What aspect of running is the most difficult? Is it, well, I'll just leave it to that.
I would say downhill technical running is the hardest thing to do not in person.
Okay.
Because most other things you can discuss it and you can get people to practice it and then they give you feedback. But it's one of those things that's very difficult to just explain, say, well, this is how you run downhill. Now that I've given you an idea of what it is, you do it. Because a lot of it comes from practice. A lot of it comes from being a bit more fearless on the downhills, particularly when they're more technical. And some of that, I think it's just easier to do when you're with someone and say, okay, now try this. And then you watch it and go, no, try that differently. So that's probably the one element that's the most difficult.
Get specific. Give me one tip of running downhill that you see that most people don't do well enough, besides just not going fast enough.
Well, ultimately, I mean, it comes down to that. It's that they have to practice the same kind of downhills they're trying to do well, which, and this is why another reason why it can be very difficult. Let's say you live in a flat city, mm-hmm. and you're training for a technical mountain race. You can mimic most elements of running by using treadmills and weight vests and get the muscle strength where it needs to be and things like that. But you can't mimic the downhill coordination or just the sensation of what that's like. So that's why that's very difficult. So one way that people can try and do that, or a couple of ways, some sports are particularly good for it. Something like soccer in particular is very good about the foot coordination. You're changing direction a lot. If you've done that in the past, it's a great background for doing downhill running. If not, it's a potential thing that you could do. It doesn't have to be that you join a team. It could just be you kick a ball around with some friends in the park just to get a little bit more of that foot coordination and the fast feet that you need for downhill running. And then also just simple things like, even if you live in a completely pancake flat city, instead of running on the paved trail in the park, maybe run on the grass next to it. Or if there's anything remotely technical, always pick the hard option. And that is a good way to just subtly over time improve your ability to do it. But there's going to be, it still won't be as good as if you can actually run on technical downhill trails. So for someone like that, if they're training for a big target race on the mountains, I'd usually say, if you can get to somewhere like that at least a couple of times, maybe it's a weekend drive or a practice race that's similar, so they can actually see what it's like in person and then see what they could maybe improve on back home with their training or what their weaknesses are that they need to try and work on a little bit more. So that's one of the most difficult things, because it's the hardest thing to mimic and the hardest thing to explain to people. But ultimately it's that they've got to practice doing it and they've got to push themselves out of their comfort zone, which means going faster than they feel comfortable with. And that's what forces the body to get better at it, because then your mind with the coordination and the synapses being created or being improved to allow you to basically just have the coordination to do that, and it to be more like an autopilot reaction rather than something you're not used to. Like any sport, the more you do it, the more it becomes natural to do it. And downhill running is the most technical, the most coordination-based element of running. And that's the one that needs specific practice as similar to it as possible.
And grabbing someone that's good at it, mm-hmm. and following right behind
exactly.
them.
Yeah.
Catch me.
Like you would with another sport, maybe.
Yeah.
Let's say you want to become a better golfer. A good golfer, watch what they're doing. They can give you guidance, and you can see what's wrong with your swing. You know, that kind of thing is exactly the same principle there.
Following the foot placement and watching what's possible really gives you confidence. If they can do it, I can do it.
Sometimes it's really high-level things. Like you see someone go down and go, oh, wow, they're doing really fast cadence. Or they're losing control this time and this time, but this is how they regain control. And just seeing that makes it more feasible to do it yourself.
Is it okay to lose control at time going downhill?
I would actually argue to do it really well. You've got to be out of control the whole time.
You know what?
That's a good point.
I used to have a different life at one point where I was very involved in downhill skiing. And one of the things that I taught when I was coaching and skiing was that downhill skiing is trying to regain balance. So you're never in perfect balance. If you're trying to feel balanced at any given time, you're behind. So you're striving to find balance as you're going down the hill rather than trying to be in balance. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I've told Don this before.
That's a really good way of putting it. When you're doing that fast downhill running, every step you've got to be doing fast enough feet, and you've got to be going down with a little bit out of control to be going really fast. And that means that ultimately when you place your foot, if it is a loose rock or it's not the best foot placement, you're already onto the next step.
Exactly.
And then that can be a little bit out of control, but then you're onto the next step again. And if you need to stop or you need to regain control, then you could do that within 10 steps, for example. But at any one point, if you're still racing and you're running it fast, you are technically out of control.
So how many steps ahead of you are your eyes placed, Ian, as you're going down? You're not looking at your feet because it's too late. So you're gazed. Can you give us any?
I would say it also partly depends on how dark it is. Because the darker it is and the more you're using a headlamp, the more that restricts things. But I find it incredibly difficult to run a technical downhill behind people. So I'll typically either just try and pass them or just have a good gap ahead of me, maybe 20, 30, 40 feet so that I can be, you know, and it's like a computer. You're calculating things without even realizing it about what footsteps you're going to do, what line you're going to take. And all of that requires being able to look ahead quite a long way. But I may be focused, say, 10 feet ahead while my brain is doing things that I'm not really fully thinking about, of thinking about what's ahead of that and also what's directly under my feet.
It is not a mindless sport. You are engaged in all, you know, balance and positioning and all the dials. I mean, it is a thinking man's or woman's runner's.
The concentration level for going down a technical downhill fast is really, it's almost like you've got throbbing veins on your head because you're having to concentrate so hard and your brain is doing a million calculations of exactly how it can keep adjusting because each step, because you are a bit out of control, it means it's not as predictable as if you were in control. So you're having to keep adjusting. And even though you're looking ahead of what you think the line is you're going to do, you're constantly adjusting that or changing your mind. And it's a very difficult skill to even explain. But ultimately, it's that your brain gets better and better at making a lot of these decisions without you having to be 100% conscious about it, even though you have to be very focused to do it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Scott.
I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
Have you ever found yourself when you don't have that cushion, if you're following someone
too close,
or if you're in a, you know, if you're out just training and just going out for an easy run and you're holding a conversation going down a hill, do you ever find that you're actually putting your feet in the same exact place as the person in front of you?
They're making the decision
for
you.
I don't know if it's a
I know what you mean. I actually find I just trip over more because. I'm looking at their feet, obviously, because the furthest ahead you can look at is their feet because they're blocking anything ahead of that.
Right, right.
And yeah, there's definitely more similarity to their line. And I'll often keep thinking, oh, that's not the step I would have done, but I didn't have enough time to think of an option because I'm 2 feet behind, so I had to choose whatever they've chosen.
An interesting life lesson. Think about it. Pause the podcast. Think about it. How does this relate to life? Okay. Yeah. Resume.
Okay. Have you ever noticed
a lot of things in ultras? Like I said, it is a metaphor for many aspects of life. Whether it's, you know, how hard work pays off, or how you go about things for the long haul, or all of these. There's so many aspects of it that I find I'm not even thinking about, but applying it to something else in my life.
Have you ever noticed in regular life when you're not on the trail that you trip over something and you realize that, you know, That time that I've spent working on that agility on that trail paid off right here. I mean, I was quicker on my feet. I sensed where balance was, and I restored my position that Scott was talking about earlier. I think there's a lot of crossover just in practical application.
Yeah, even just walking down the street. Like, you know, several times where I'm, because you're not thinking about it if you're just walking along, and maybe you twist an ankle accidentally or a stone rolls under your foot, and you're just walking. But you realize that the ankle strength and the coordination that you've been working on with the trail running has paid off because it's allowing you to not have a twisted ankle now.
Ian, what do you love most about trail running?
Ooh, I like that.
There's a lot of aspects. In terms of just the pure physical side, I'd say I just love downhill running. Mm-hmm. In terms of the competition, I'm a very competitive person, so I love the competition. I love the friendly atmosphere of it all. I mean, it's difficult to say there's one aspect because they're all intertwined. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing, let's say again, Western States to give an example of something I'm very familiar with, if I'm running downhill there and I'm running with some of my friends and it's near the front of the pack, I've got the competition there. I've got the social side of it. I've got the fun views. I've got the enjoyment of running downhill and just that sensation of a big event as well. So all of that kind of is at the same time. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of all a really important part to it.
Good answer.
What's on your bucket list? A race that you have not yet done, but's on there?
Probably the most obvious one would be UTMB, but I'm in no rush to do it. I will do it at some point, but it probably won't be for 5 or more years, I'd guess, because there's lots of other things that I like doing at the moment. And in particular, I like Leadville, and Leadville is always about a week or two away from UTMB. So I want to run Leadville quite a few more times, and then I'll do UTMB. But that's probably the biggest one, but there's so many new races as well. I want to do a lot of races that are maybe a little more low-key, but just I know are spectacular. So I'd like to do Hard Rock, although it is pretty major as well, but I'd like to do Bighorn 100-miler. It's mainly 100-milers, to be honest, because you just see so much more with those. But there's so many really scenic ones that I'd like to do if it wasn't for the fact that running 10 100-milers in a year would be a stupid idea.
So I'm curious about your statement that you're really into Leadville right now. You've won the race twice. What still intrigues you about Leadville that keeps you focused on that right now?
I think it's partly the fact that it's so different to what I grew up with. I mean, I grew up in England at sea level. Everywhere I lived was completely flat. Was born in Northamptonshire, studied in Cambridge, which is known for being completely flat, London, completely flat. And then at the age of 29, I moved to the US and I started living in the mountains. And it's like, oh, this is actually what I like. And I'm amazed I didn't work this out earlier. So Leadville, it has altitude, it has mountains. It's just a fun place. It's a big race. So there's a lot of people in the 100 miler. All of those just kind of play into it. I've kind of realized I just like altitude races. I like the fact that altitude seems to be something that my body deals with relatively well, and that just almost come from a kind of scientific experiment of one, I want to see how I can improve that. And also then, you know, from the coaching perspective, I like learning more about running, so it's really intriguing from that. But I think part of it as well is that course record, Matt Carpenter's record, is such an iconic one. I want to just have a few more attempts at that and see if it's actually possible, because I think if I could do a perfect race and nail everything, put it all together, I could see it's maybe just possible. So that's very appealing to see if I can reach my peak, and there's such a clear benchmark of what to aim for there.
Let's talk about Matt's record out there. Why is it so iconic? Where is it?
So it's 15 hours 42 at Leadville, which is ridiculously fast for doing a race at between about 10 and 12,000 feet the whole time and with 15,500 feet of climbing. But I think it was the fact that he was very scientific in the way he did things, and also he was probably the best high-altitude runner that we've ever known. I mean, he did a lot of scientific stuff, doing, say, marathons at different altitudes, and from a lot of testing that was done on him, he seemed to be about as good as anyone ever has been running at altitude. So just knowing that, it kind of sets a benchmark of maybe what humans can do. Although saying that, he only did Leadville twice, so I'm sure if he'd have done it a few more times, he could probably have refined it even more. But he had a really good race there. It was very even pacing. And I don't know, there's just something about that really appeals. I mean, when it's a big, iconic, historical race like that I've heard about for years and years, and now I get a chance to go there, and it also seems to suit me. So there's something about the combination of the hills and the flat running and the altitude that just suits me physiologically. So I it's a race where I feel like I can really push myself to my limit and be competitive there.
Scott, did you have something? Because I have something on that very topic, and we don't want to take too much of your time because we know you're over there building golden tickets to get out there on this coaching thing. What about that dichotomy of your body is best suited for short, but your mind is suited for long? I mean, how do you coach on that? How do you advise on that? And what, do you have any thoughts on that?
Ultimately, the main way you're going to get benefits with most training is you focus on your weaknesses. So, and make it specific, obviously, to the race you're doing. So if you want to get better at the 5K, but you're just an awesome endurance runner with no speed, then you're going to work better to, it's going to be more effective to work on the speed elements of it. And that's a very obvious thing. But even, say, in a longer race on trails, you might be better at, in my case, downhill and weaker at uphill. So there's more to gain from focusing on the uphill. So whether it's about speed or the type of terrain or the distances, work out where the weaknesses are and therefore how to improve those, because you'll get a more marginal gains from working on the weaknesses than you will just from refining your strengths even more. But also that can be, that comes down to a lot of other things, and that is very much personal preference. Do you just want to do races that suit you? Do you want to do races that challenge you because it doesn't suit you? There's lots of reasons to do a race, and then depending on that and depending on what your personal strengths and weaknesses are, to then get improvements towards that that'll pay off and get the most bang for your buck from the training that you're doing.
And I guess we have to remember we're running for joy too. I mean, it's not very many of us are making a living from how fast we go from start to finish. And
well, I think everyone in ultra running is doing it for enjoyment, because there's just not enough money that, you know, there's no $1 million prizes where people go, okay, I hate this, but I'm going to do it because I'm going to win $1 million. So I think, you know, you look at all of the runners across ultra running, no matter whether they're making a living from it or not, there's a lot of enjoyment there, because there's not enough reward financially if that is your only motivation.
So where is the sport going, Ian? Is it moving towards that sustainability for professional ultra endurance
athletes?
I think
it is. It depends on what you call sustainable. I mean, I don't think there's going to be more than a handful of people who can make even a half-decent living compared to normal wages in the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably going to be the case for another decade or two. And I can never see the point where you've got ultra runners who are winning so much prize money and have such big sponsorship deals that they're driving Ferraris. Hmm. The sport doesn't have enough appeal, and it can never get to that kind of scale. But it's certainly going to head towards more professionalism, more people who are doing it full time, more prize money, more sponsors, but just never to the point where it's, you know, mega bucks.
And one of the things you're doing with your coaching, you're bringing opportunity to people not only to do well in their A race and to their chance to get into the Western States and have a successful outcome. So when they look at that belt buckle, whatever the color it is, it's one that they can really feel good about what happened by bringing a coach in at the right time. But you're also bringing opportunity for people that just love the sport and want to be around it more to create a lifestyle and create a living by becoming a coach.
Yeah, I mean, all the coaches I have were already doing some coaching, other than Ellie, who I gave them kind of coaching behind my philosophy as well, so that they would fit in line with that more. But the people who I've got within the company are people I know very well. I know their mindset, their general philosophy about their racing. Several of them I either have coached or do coach. So it's nice that I'm able to help them to make a living from their running. And especially since, you know, that you only get a few years where you can maybe make the prize money and get the sponsorships. And after that, if you want to make your living from running, you've still got to have some other options. So coaching is a very good one there, that with all the experience that people like Ellie and Sean and Sandra and Liza have, they're very good communicators about being able to help other people with that. So it's a lot of fun for me that I can help them make a living, but it's not like I could just take on anyone as a coach. And I've been very specific with who I've picked, and they're people I know very well, and I trust them both from their work ethic and their knowledge, as well as their ability to communicate and coach people. So, I'd love to have more coaches in future, but at the moment, there's not really anyone I can think of that I'd want to bring on board. So over time, I'm sure that'll change, but there's only a few people who I feel like I can trust enough to kind of represent the brand in that way.
Well, Ian, you've made an impact on the sport, not only from wearing the bib and setting an example out there, but you've helped others and are helping others now to reach some of their dreams and goals and visions. So we appreciate that. Appreciate you giving the golden ticket to us.
Yeah.
To get a chance to talk to you.
One thing I did want to just mention is The other half of what I do is skyrunning. So the US Skyrunner series is going to be announced about the time this podcast comes out on the 9th of November. That'll be out there. So I spend a lot of my time doing that, and that's, you know, the pure mountain side of things. So equally with the coaching being a lot of fun, where I get to speak to runners and help guide them, and especially when they complete a race and it means so much to them, I find that incredibly fulfilling, way more than when I was an economist previously. I never had that kind of job satisfaction. But the same with the skyrunning stuff. I get a lot of people saying that they love the fact that there's more options for this kind of really hardcore mountain running in the US. And so it's just enjoyable that I've been able to get a few things that are really important to me, and then work out a way that I could not have to do my old desk job at the same time.
Tell us a little bit about the skyrunning series and where someone could go to find more information about it.
Well, it's all going to be at the moment we have the 2015 information on the website, but it's usskyrunning.com. It's basically just high alpine, really difficult technical races. Basically, skyrunning has been around for about 20 odd years. At the moment, it's really been popularized in Europe, in particular, by people like Kilian Jornet, Emily Forsberg. It's kind of a, you know, the really hardcore level of pure mountain stuff. And so there's series in multiple countries around the world, and the US one, we're trying to capture that same style of running as much as possible and just really pick races that are fun. If you like the mountains and you want a real challenge and you want something that's going to be tough, but not so tough that, you know, you're going to kill yourself or anything ridiculous, then that's the type of races we have. And they're all over the country, predominantly in the higher areas, as you'd expect, because skyrunning is about high altitude mountain running. But from the 9th of November, it'll be have all the information for the 2016 set of races, which will start they'll basically be from June till October. So again, as you'd expect for mountain races, it's during the mountain season. It's so much fun to be involved with that and to get to see that sport evolving and coming over to the US a little bit more.
What's the distance on one of those races? What is an out and back, or give us a little detail for us aren't used to it?
There's basically three different disciplines. So you've got the vertical kilometer, which is just straight uphill. Mm. It does 1,000 meters of climb in a 5K. So about 3,300 feet of climbing within a 5K race, just straight up a mountain. And that's a very hard type of race, but it's over quickly.
And the finish is at the top, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So usually it's something like you finish at the gondola or something, and that takes you back down. Then we have the sky distance, which is typically between about a half marathon and marathon. And again, just huge amounts of climbing, spectacular views. It's very much about capturing the beauty of the mountains and being able to enjoy them. And then the longest distance is the ultra, which is basically a 50K or beyond. Most of them are around the 50K distance. So at the moment, we don't really have anything that's super long. And that allows it to be kind of done in one day. It's not quite as you're not having to go all through the night and deal with being out there for, you know, the exposure in the mountains for even longer. And also it means that it's quicker. So the people doing them have to be very quick if they want to be winning it, but it's still achievable. And it's more feasible for someone to maybe go from normal trail racing to doing these hardcore races and not be worried that it's too much of a step up for them.
And if a person was going to transition from the trail run to that, are there any, as a coach, are there any cautions that you would have for that type of change and impact to the body?
I'd say that the main one is just the altitude element. If you live somewhere that's lower elevation, just be aware that the altitude is going to make it more difficult and make it slower. It's always a potential danger, but any trail race has potential dangers. So it's just to make sure that you maybe start off with something that sounds like it's not too big a step up. See how you like that, and then go on to the most hardcore races you want to do. I mean, there's no cap on where you can go with the types of races you do. It could be longer, it could be higher, it could be more climbing. And I think that's just one of the fun things about running. There's a lot of different directions it can take you.
What's your favorite discipline out of those three? The vertical mile straight up, the half marathon to marathon, or the 50K?
I think I'd have to say the ultra, because I'm just not quick enough for the short stuff, and I'm not good enough on the uphill. Particularly a VK, I get smoked in those. So they're kind of fun for training, but I just can't compete at them.
Well, Ian, we look forward to monitoring the Golden Ticket race series and seeing who gets in over the next, I guess it would be...
Well, coming up on the lottery for Western States and then the 6 months well, after
yes,
the beginning
the next
of the year.
6 months now, yeah. The last one is Lake Sonoma, so that's the 9th of April.
Okay, and the training component is going to be announced beginning of December. That's this
year,
right?
Yeah, the winner of that. But of course, anyone else can hire me anyway. So it's just there's only one freebie.
Okay, all right.
So if we want to reach you, Ian, what are the best spots to get you out? Your blog spot is charminian.blogspot.com.
Probably easier just to go to the coaching website because it links to everything anyway. And that's charminultra.com. So my name. Not like the toilet paper, but it is a play on that. So Charman Ultra. And then on Twitter, it's Charman Ian. On Facebook, again, Charman Ian. So, yeah, just Google my name and it'll come up because it's an odd name. It's not a common one.
I was going to say, just go to Google and put in fast. And you'll find Ian. Hey, Ian, thanks for...
Or something, and if you did that.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right.